for Southern Wisconsin.
Literacy Network invites you to help them celebrate 50 years and toast to the next half century and free adult literacy education. From 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th at Boardman Clark, you can enjoy signature cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, and a program that features speeches from Lupita Montoto of La Movida and other supporters. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at literacynetwork.org/50th celebration. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 21st. In addition to the event, you can also check out the silent auction, which is live now through April 25th. That's a toast to 50 years of Literacy Network at Boardman Clark, 1 South Pinckney, from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th. You are listening to WORT Madison.
Her Turn, a program of news and information from a feminist perspective. I'm Christina Kivlin.
And I'm Madison Delier. On today's programs, we're going to be speaking of how many women are being turned away from emergency rooms over prenatal care.
The U.S. Department of Education has finalized pro-equality Title IX rule.
Can gender and women's studies programs survive in a climate of anti-wokeness? When the Wisconsin state legislator holds up funding unless DEI positions are cut, facilities around the country are speaking out. We'll have the report.
Afghan women fear international recognition of the Taliban.
International scholars rally around a feminist Palestinian academic arrested in Jerusalem on Thursday. So stay tuned for all of this and more on the April 21st, 2024 edition of Her Turn.
Reports have revealed that pregnant women are being denied treatments in emergency rooms. This is especially happening in states that have enacted strict abortion laws, which cause confusion for doctors and medical staff in providing treatments within legal boundaries. Investigations uncovered very disturbing cases where women have miscarried after being turned away. Federal law requires women in active labor to be treated and stabilized. Joe Biden and Javier Becerra, the health secretary, have both publicly vowed vigilance in enforcing the law. Even as states have enacted strict abortion laws, the White House has argued that if hospitals receive Medicare funds, they must provide stabilizing care, including abortions.
On Friday, the U.S. Department of Education announced that it has finalized a Title IX rule that clarifies the scope of non-discrimination and protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity throughout educational activities and programs. This new rule makes it clear to school districts across the country that they have an obligation to protect students from discrimination. With the increasing number of anti-LGBTQ+ attacks by state legislators across the country, the Human Rights Campaign and other parties urgently call for Title IX rule protections for transgendered student athletes from discrimination and other rules for access to health care, broadly including transgender veterans. HRC President Kelly Robinson said school administrators would immediately act to implement anti-biases and anti-bullying and harassment programs that ensure misgendering stops, the cruelty against LGBTQ+ students ends, and that every student has access to an education free of discrimination. This updated rule is a reminder of what Title IX has been designed to accomplish for more than 50 years, to ensure students are safe from abuse, harassment, and discrimination while they pursue their education.
Today, we delve into the disturbing reality faced by women in elected positions, exemplified by Kathy Buchvar, former Secretary of State in Pennsylvania, and Carly Coppice, Elections Clerk of Weld County, Colorado. Both women are a part of the 80% of women who run elections in the U.S. and have faced harassment and threats, with Buchvar being forced to relocate and conceal her identity in public. Coppice had to hide her pregnancy to avoid harassment. When her pregnancy was revealed to the public, she received messages such as, quote, "I'm going to pray for your child because his mother is a demon," end quote. Buchvar was subjected to numerous slurs, such as the constant use of the C word and whore, being thrown constantly by right-wing harassers. Their experiences highlight the pervasive misogyny in politics. Studies reveal a broader pattern of abuse against women in public office, creating a culture of fear and intimidation that undermines democracy. Urgent systemic change is needed to ensure a safe environment for all elected officials, regardless of gender.
Federal authorities have finalized the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, which guarantees, quote, reasonable, unquote, accommodations for pregnant individuals and those with related medical conditions. The legislation, which also covers accommodations for abortion procedures and recovery, aims to address workplace discrimination. While facing opposition from anti-abortion groups, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission defended its decision based on Title VII protections. This move marks a crucial step in ensuring quality and protection for pregnant workers nationwide.
According to reports, women's studies program and women and gender centers are increasingly worried about their survival on college campuses. Although the UW-Madison campus seems to be doing well financially, others in the system are not. Her Turn reporter Arlene Zoucha has more.
A recent report shows many campuses are running deficits. Two-year rural campuses are closing, with other threats ahead. And it's not just Wisconsin. Laws passed in 5 states, with more being considered in 20 others, are banning or restricting diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, meaning programs and jobs are being cut. And who's being hurt the most? Students in gender and women or ethnic study programs. Stephanie Ritalotti is the director of the UW Gender and Women's Studies Consortium. She helped to put on this year's Women and Gender Studies Conference.
We have a 45-plus year history, so the theme of this conference was honoring our past and securing our future, and one of the things that we wanted to do today and over the next 2 days is just really celebrate the fact that we've been here for over 50 years on most of our campuses, and most of us don't have any plans to leave. But we also want to be cognizant of the fact that there's a lot of challenges and what are our paths forward.
The first plenary of the conference addressed some of the issues that are threatening higher education today. Angela Clark Taylor is with Student Affairs at Florestone Mather Center for Women at Case University in Ohio. She also works with the National Women's Studies Association, or NWSA.
We started getting reports when I was on the executive committee of NWSA in 2022 from Wyoming, North Dakota, Florida, Texas, about different ways that either state governments or boards of directors of institutions were working to defund or close women and gender and sexuality studies departments. And so there was a series of announcements that came out from NWSA and petitions to support those departments, but we realized that we lacked a lot of information.
Gathering that information meant sending out surveys to hundreds of universities around the country, asking questions about budgets and support for gender and women's studies programs and departments. Hannah Regan is also from Case University. She explains what some of the survey reveals.
The most common sentiment we heard was they're supportive in principle or in words, but they are not supportive when it comes time for material support, especially funding. When we had more pernicious answers, it was along these lines, that they knew that DEI was important, depending on the particular state context, and that it was a thing they were selling for the university, but when it came time to actually buckle down and study how it was really impacting their institution, they were far less interested in supporting or funding that. Some people were very on board with supporting women, very narrowly defined as biological born women, but when it came to thinking about racism, transgender individuals, ability, any of these intersections that many of us hold very dear when looking at women's studies, that tended to be more challenging depending on who was in leadership. And so when the program turned towards social justice, anti-racist, feminist, supporting of queerness, or when it expanded beyond that, cisgender, heterosexual women, people could face more opposition from leadership as well.
The survey also asked questions about space allowed on campus for these programs, reports Regan.
For space, we had kind of a difficult time with this question, so the data isn't necessarily super helpful, but 70% reported no change in their space, but a lot of that was we didn't have a space to begin with, and that didn't change. And 9% did report an increase in space, and 21% reported a decrease.
According to comments from the survey, support for gender and women's studies was the highest when leadership actually had a background in the field. Even when diversity is a stated goal of the university, the commitment often doesn't go very deep, says Clark Taylor.
Folks talked about being tokenized, like rolled out when it was needed to recruit students to make the institution look good, but then not supported later. And also, we asked folks if they felt comfortable to speak about women's issues, and we got interesting. We got about 50-50 people saying yes and no that they couldn't. But once we looked at the qualitative comments, it was like, yeah, I can talk about women's issues, but I can't talk about reproductive justice.
According to survey responses, the climate for higher education around the country is pretty similar, even when a state hasn't initiated bans on teaching, like Florida, or diversity, like Texas. Faculty report feeling watched and monitored, leading to tension and stress, regardless of location. Stephanie Ritalotti from UW-Madison says the budget cuts in the UW system have been tremendously significant, as shown when she collected the results of the survey in Wisconsin.
A lot of our programs are under-resourced, and I would say probably more than 50% of our faculty and staff would say that they don't have the resources to function at the demands that students are asking for. Policy choices have been extremely hard at the state level and budget choices that have been made. Political attacks are being reported on almost all of our campuses for community members, students, and staff who are in our classes. Burnout and exhaustion is extremely prominent still post-pandemic, and I think that's something that we're all struggling with and grappling with both in our own work and with students. And despite growing enrollments and student engagement, I don't think that women's and gender studies and race, gender, and sexuality studies is always understood by deans, provosts, and chancellors that we report to. We still have, even at the dean level, people who think gender and women's studies is a new field, that it's been around for 3 or 5 years, and it's easily merged or dispensed with when they're looking at numbers.
She says shutting down two-year campuses is having a detrimental effect on those who are already underserved.
These are critical access campuses for students, and they're also critical to race, gender, and sexuality studies across UW's system. We have faculty and staff on all of these campuses. We have courses and collaborations that we rely on. We have gender equity centers. We have pride centers on these campuses. There are library and art holdings that are being impacted, and these are access campuses for students who are already institutionally marginalized, first-generation students, students who are just kind of testing out the waters to see where they want to go with their degree, and has been a critical part of tertiary education.
And it's not just the programs and campuses. Student centers have been hit too, says Ritalotti.
These centers are critical partners. We collaborate with them for programming. A lot of gender equity and pride center directors also teach classes in our programs and departments. And also, one of the things that I've been hearing and seeing with the budget cuts is these programs have been getting cut and it's not been on the radar in the same way. We've also seen changes in positions where these were PhD level positions, maybe reporting through academic affairs, and now they're student affairs level positions, and the qualifications that we're recruiting for has gone down, and the number of staff supporting people in the director roles has also gone down, and that creates more stresses and strains. And I think almost all of our campuses reported really high turnover rate in these positions. So several places said, yes, we have a Pride Center, but the position has been open for 9 months and we're not sure what the status of it is.
Ridolati lists some of the challenges gender and women and ethnic studies have faced at the UW within the last year.
Last year we had a freedom of speech survey conducted in the fall, and the results from that came out and were circulated. In 2023, diversity statements and job applications were eliminated. In December of 2023, right before the end of the semester, when we were all working on finals and other projects, there was a legislative agreement regarding EDI where there was going to be a realignment of 43 positions across UW system. And the overall impacts that we've seen so far have been a lot of turnover. So people who are reporting up through an EDI structure, a lot of times center director positions, more people have been looking for jobs outside of state because they feel like these jobs understandably do not have stability and are precarious and also just not supported on our campuses.
But she also points to what she sees as some of the advantages at the UW.
The strengths are we have really, really strong cross campus network. So people are collaborating with academic staff councils, faculty senate. We have lots of leadership on university and college level committees. We have a lot of disciplinary breadth and depth across UW system. Our course enrollments continue to hold extremely steady. The curriculum is deeply innovative and responsive to the changing demands and needs that students are bringing to us. And the faculty, staff, and instructors that are running our classes across the state are fantastic people with a great deal of dedication and passion and talent for the work that we do.
Stephanie Ridolati is the director of the UW Gender and Women's Studies Consortium. She, along with Angela Clark Taylor and Hannah Regan from the Flora Stone Mather Center for Women at Case University in Ohio, spoke at the UW Women and Gender Studies Conference this month. For her turn, I'm Arlene Zalcha.
This is again Radio Yerevan with our news.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to turn on the machine. This is Radio Yerevan. My name is Hans Ivanovich Hagen, and this is the news. I was born in 66.
A report by UN Women and other UN organizations convened 745 Afghan women for countrywide consultations and surveys on their situation under Taliban rule. The majority of these women expressed dread and anxiety at the possibility of international recognition of the Taliban, now referred to as the de facto authorities or the DFA. The majority of women have stated that if there's to be international recognition, it should only be contingent of the removal of all restrictions placed on women and girls by the DFA. Many women have expressed that they feel unsafe leaving their homes without a male guardian. One woman stated that she was informed by police that they sought to remove women and girls from all public spaces step by step. Women have expressed deep disappointment in the states and they continue to engage with the DFA, overlooking the severity of unprecedented women rights issues and otherwise known as gender apartheid. Pale Tide Afghanistan women stated that linking international aid to better conditions for women and opening lines of communications for women to address the DFA directly is the best way to improve their situation.
On Monday, the Supreme Court upheld House Bill 71, which aims to ban gender-affirming care for minors, which includes hormone therapy, puberty blockers, and gender-affirming surgeries. Not only will this ban take these life-saving treatments away from minors, but will also punish medical professionals who provide gender-affirming care. Many medical professionals can even face up to 10 years in prison for providing these services. These forms of gender-affirming care bans have been known to increase anxiety and depression in teens, solidified by a survey done by the Trevor Project. This bill does not have teenagers' well-being in mind. These anti-LGBTQ plus laws continue to decline the mental health of teens all over America.
For years, the Federal Correctional Institute of Dublin in the San Francisco Bay Area has been known to be rampant with sexual assaults of female inmates at the hands of staff. These sexual assault cases are so common that employees called the facility, quote, the rape club, end quote. Other countless accounts of rape, sexual assault, and voyeurism on top on some top leaders of the institution were driven out, with one former warden even being convicted. However, these efforts made such a little difference that Cully Peter, director of the Bureau of Prisons, said that the prison, quote, is not meeting standards, unquote, and will be shut down. Roughly 600 women will be transferred to other federal facilities and the employees reassigned.
Israeli police arrested the internationally renowned feminist Palestinian academic Nadira Shaloub Kevorkian at her home in Jerusalem on Thursday on charges of incitement to violence. Shaloub Kevorkian, who holds both Israeli and U.S. citizenship, was suspended by Hebrew University last month after saying in an interview Israel was committing genocide in Gaza, though the university later reinstated her. Democracy Now! Discussed the situation on Friday, beginning with a clip of Shaloub Kevorkian from the program in March.
The question remains whether what is teachable, what should be written, what is publishable, what we can speak as scholars that are studying state criminality as opposing to what is going on, as opposing to what the state is doing is not accepted, so they throw us out of the university. And this is the same policy that the state of Israel is doing outside. So it's silencing, it's preventing people from speaking, it's threatening, it's punishing, and it's also done in a very degraded and indignifying manner, calling my student a day before the end of the first semester and telling me you're suspended is something that is beyond any expectations. But this is, and stressing it's a Zionist institution, you can't abide by these rules, you're out. My only concern, Amy, today is the safety of students, the safety of my students, Jewish and Palestinian, that are standing against genocide, standing against the war, refusing to see the continuous and ongoing atrocities. My really concern is the silencing of dissent all over the world, because we see it in academic institutions. The question, if we think that academic institutions should work according and by the orders from the state, I don't know why we're having academic institution. Academia and research requires that we're attentive to details, to what goes on, to the life of women, men, children. And I'm really concerned today. And of course, I must clearly state that the behavior of the university is a behavior that is threatening the safety of our students, the safety of colleagues that are speaking against the genocide, and my own personal safety as a person who lives in Jerusalem, and the safety of my family.
Over 100 professors around the world released a statement calling for her immediate release, calling her arrest an attack, quote, on all Palestinian scholars, students, and activists who bring to light the violent and genocidal nature of the Israeli state, they wrote. Today, Professor Shaloub Kevorkian had a hearing where a judge ordered her release, but she has not been released, as the Israeli government is reportedly appealing. For more, we're joined by Sara Ihmoud, a Chicana Palestinian anthropologist, assistant professor of anthropology and peace and conflict studies at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's founder of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Professor Nadra Shaloub Kevorkian is her mentor. If you can start off by giving us the latest, what have you heard of this hearing and why she was arrested?
Thanks for having me, Amy, and thank you for bringing light to the case of Professor Shaloub Kevorkian, who, as you noted, is an internationally renowned feminist scholar and human rights activist who has been working to bring attention to the situation of Palestinian women and children under Israeli military occupation for the past three decades. As far as we understand, Professor Shaloub Kevorkian was violently arrested from her home in the Armenian quarter of Jerusalem's Old City yesterday around 5 p.m. The police raided her home and confiscated her belongings, including her laptop, some books from what I understand, as well as a poster of the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. Professor Shaloub Kevorkian, as you noted, has been subjected to violent repression and harassment by the Hebrew University for speaking out against the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And she was suspended from her teaching duties in March, though later reinstated once it became clear that there was no basis for the allegations against her. Ultimately, We hold the Hebrew University of Jerusalem responsible for her arrest and detention because of its persistent and public repression of her academic freedom, which led directly to yesterday's arrest. And we see this as yet another example of Israel attacking Palestinians wherever they are, whoever they are. It underscores that no Palestinian is safe under Israel's racist apartheid rule, not even someone like Dr. Shalhoub Kevorkian, who is both an Israeli and American citizen and a world-renowned and respected feminist scholar. And it's important to note as well that Israel routinely holds Palestinians captive and imprisons them without trial, without due process, and under inhumane conditions, including children, and that this is just both unjust and illegal. And this is an attack on her as both a Palestinian and a scholar who is rightfully speaking out against Israel's well-documented human rights abuses and ongoing genocide. So as far as we understand, the Jerusalem court magistrate had ordered her release under the condition of a 20,000 shekel bail. However, the state and the police are appealing, and they have taken her to the central court where they're still holding her. So we are still awaiting further details about whether she will be released or whether the state will continue holding her.
Can you talk about how you know her, Professor Sada Ahmoud?
I have known Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian for over a decade. I first met her in Occupied East Jerusalem when I was a graduate student just beginning to pursue my PhD dissertation research, and she has become one of my dearest friends and mentors over the past decade. She's someone that has really opened my eyes and many across the world to the intimacies of Israeli settler colonial violence and repression in Occupied East Jerusalem and across the Palestinian territory. Her work has focused on specifically the conditions of women, how patriarchy and colonialism intersect to shape the lives of women, and what justice looks like for Palestinian women. And her work has also really taken central imperative to understanding the conditions of Palestinian children and speaking out against the persistent human rights abuses of Palestinian children in occupied territory. She is the scholar who founded the concept of unchilding to help us further understand, as scholars across the world interested in children's rights, how settler colonial states typically shape the lives and limit the futures of children, indigenous children, and racialized children across the globe. So her work has been absolutely pathbreaking and important, not only in the Palestinian context, but in global contexts where populations are facing racialized and gendered repression and violence. And she has been a beloved mentor to many, including myself, and she has always centered love in the way that she cares for her students, for scholars in her community, and she continues to center that ethics and method of love in the work that she does in the community and with her students across the Hebrew University and beyond.
In addition to being a professor at Hebrew University, she also taught at Queen Mary University in London. Another professor there is Neve Gordon, the Israeli scholar who we also recently did an interview with. He just tweeted, "The judge not at a hearing, the judge to police. I can understand that you wanted the arrest to conduct searches, but so far you've not found anything that justifies the arrest, and I have not received any other explanation. The pages you found are an expression of opinion," the judge said. As we wrap up, Professor Ahmoud, the significance of this and why you feel she's being targeted right now.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think, you know, it's important to stress the absurdity of her portrayal by the police as dangerous. And yet this follows a history of Palestinians generally and Palestinian women in particular being portrayed as a dangerous threat to Israeli security. Obviously, we see how the entire population of Gaza has been dehumanized, and that has provided the pretext for Israel's continued genocidal assault on the entire civilian population of the Gaza Strip. And of course, Israel sees Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian as dangerous because her work for the last several decades exposes exactly the opposite, of course, that is the humanity of the Palestinian people in the face of the inhumanity of the Israeli state in its quest to continue to occupy, terrorize, and brutalize the Palestinian people and repress our movement for liberation. So we are calling on international scholars, activists, and people of conscience everywhere to continue maintaining pressure for her immediate release and for all of the charges against her to be dropped. We are outraged by this unlawful action, and we refuse the continuing silence and violence by the Israeli state and its institutions against the Palestinian people, and for those who, like Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian, continue being a voice of light and love, standing for justice and liberation. Again, Professor Shalhoub Kevorkian has always centered her love for her people, for her students' safety and security. And it's important that we follow in her footsteps, in the path that she has been taking herself and leading us in embodying hope and the necessity that we continue speaking out against Israel's ongoing genocidal violence.
That was Sadaa Ikhmoud, Assistant Professor of Anthropology and Peace and Conflict Studies at the College of Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, the founder of the Palestinian Feminist Collective, discussing the arrest of Professor Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian in Jerusalem on Thursday.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think... Oh, bondage! Up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
And that's all for today, folks. Sources used in today's program include Democracy Now!, TheFeminist.org Newswire, The Human Rights Campaign, The Guardian, The Associated Press, and The New York Times.
Today's edition of Her Turn was produced by Joanne Powers, who is also our on-air engineer. Other contributors include Garima Gupta, Madison Delier, Arlene Zoucha, and Christina Kivlin. So stay tuned for 2.5 hours of Women in Music on Her Infinite Variety with host Nikki. For Her Turn, I'm Christina Kivlin.
And for Her Turn, I'm Madison Delier. And remember that our liberation is bound together. Have a fiercely feminist day.
WRT
89.9
FM.